from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Its cast is aging. Its credibility has taken a hit, along with Dan Rather's. Many wonder about its future, but after 36 years, 60 Minutes remains one of the highest-rated, most profitable shows in the history of television, meaning it's maintaining its own identity on a crowded, ever-shifting media stage. Tonight on Point, the story of one of television's most acclaimed and still controversial programs, 60 Minutes. But first, in the Rose Garden yesterday, President Bush said John Kerry's critical statements on Iraq can, quote, embolden an enemy. Dana Milbank, White House correspondent for The Washington Post, reports that leading Republicans are stepping up the theme that criticism of the Iraq effort is tantamount to comforting a foe. I asked him to describe the trend.
The rhetoric seems to have developed in this campaign beyond the already quite heated and nasty back and forth into levels approaching accusing the opponent of treason, using the traditional definition of giving aid and comfort to the enemy. President Bush said in the Rose Garden meeting with the Iraqi interim prime minister that Kerry's words can embolden an enemy. These are almost the exact same words that were used by South Dakota Senate candidate John Thune on Meet the Press just last Sunday. Then we had Orrin Hatch saying the terrorists, quote, are going to throw everything they can between now and the election to try and elect Kerry, unquote, which was in turn very similar to the House Speaker Dennis Hastert saying, I don't have data or intelligence to tell me one thing or another, but I would think that they would be more apt to go for somebody who would file a lawsuit with the world court or something rather than respond with troops.
And then he was asked whether he believed al-Qaeda would be more successful under John Kerry than under George Bush, and he said?
Exactly. He said, that's my opinion, yes. So he was very clear about it, and others have done this as well. The Deputy Secretary of State, Richard Armitage, Pat Roberts, the Chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, has made remarks to this effect. And obviously, Vice President Cheney got quite a bit of attention when he was warning that we could be hit hard by terrorists under a Kerry presidency.
And then a little broader, I guess it was Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage in Warsaw this week saying that he thought terrorists in Iraq are, quote, trying to influence the election against President Bush.
Right. I mean, there are two things going on here. One is suggesting that Kerry, in criticizing the war effort, is helping the enemy. That's obviously the more serious charge. The other charge is just saying that they believe that the terrorists in Iraq or elsewhere would prefer, if John Kerry is elected, that in essence they're bringing about violence to try to bring about President Bush's defeat. Now, obviously, nobody's been very effective at polling terrorists to know who their actual preferred candidate is here, but some people, you can argue the question either way, whether they would do better under a President Bush or a President Kerry, but it's obviously can be a frightening bit of rhetoric for people to hear.
Now, this didn't just show up yesterday. It was much earlier in the month when the vice president, of course, as you noted, he said that on Election Day, quote, if we make the wrong choice, then the danger is that we'll be hit again, that we'll be hit in a way that will be devastating. And, of course, he came back later and said he wasn't suggesting that the country would be attacked if Kerry were elected. But it's interesting now, Dana Milbank, after John Kerry has, just in the last week, begun to deliver much, much sharper criticism of the Iraq war effort and President Bush's handling of the war on terrorism, is this a responding spike in this rhetoric to Kerry's attack?
Well, it seems unlikely that all of this would have occurred using such similar words from so many people if it weren't deliberate, and it obviously is an escalation. What's driving this is really quite simple, that, you know, we can sit here and say, isn't it a shame when people use negative politics, and that really alienates voters. And that, while it may be true in theory, what's much more obvious is it actually motivates a lot of people. And, I mean, fear is a very powerful factor in getting people out to the polls, and there's every indication that negative campaigning is highly effective.
And you're quoting people in your story in the Washington Post saying, suggesting that it indicates a decision by the Republican hierarchy to put this charge out there consistently.
Right, and I'll be clear that that's that's people guessing who aren't involved in it. But if you see remarks being made by the president, by the vice president, by the Speaker of the House, by Republican Party officials at the state level, by various chairmen of committees in the Senate that presumably that's not an accident when you have that many similar remarks in a very short period of time.
Dana, the Democrats, the Kerry campaign, have responded saying this is un-American. Does the record bear that out? Is this kind of attack in the midst of a campaign un-American?
Not at all. It's a great American tradition to accuse the enemy of treason and sedition. But, you know, this has been going back 200 years. So, you know, irresponsible charges always come up in campaigns. And it's not, you know, we can be referees and say, hey, that crosses the line. But it's, in the media, it's not really our job to say. It's the question is, will voters say, you know something, this is unfair. But voters so far really, at least as the polls indicate, haven't said that. They haven't, by and large, thought the Swift boat attacks were unfair or the whole business about President Bush's time in the National Guard. So it seems the tolerance for shock and alarm among the electorate is pretty high.
Going all the way back to March, Congressman Tom Cole, Republican from Oklahoma, saying, drawing the equation pretty starkly, he said, if George Bush loses the election, Osama bin Laden wins the election. Dana Milbank, John Kerry is again today going very hard on the Iraq front. He said today that Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense, was living in a fantasy world of spin. If John Kerry continues to go at the Iraq war effort, do you expect this kind of rhetoric suggesting that his election would be a boon to bin Laden to continue to escalate?
Back and forth, again and again, particularly in Iraq, that's where they feel vulnerable to Kerry's charges. So, yes, I mean, the more inroads Kerry makes and the more aggressive he is, and he's learned that he has to be, there are two responses from the Bush side. One is to say Kerry flip-flops and he can't be trusted on this. And if that doesn't work, then you get into the more serious charge saying he is doing harm to American troops and American interests.
Is there such a thing as stepping over the line here, or is all fair in love and presidential politics?
You and I can say, look, implying that the political opponent is guilty of treason would seem to go beyond what is reasonable in a presidential campaign. But that's not for us to decide. There's no rules here. It's ultimately up to the voters to decide, and we will learn on November 2nd whether this rhetoric went over the line and alienated people or, in fact, was successful.
Well, it's hardball. Dana Milbank, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dana Milbank is White House correspondent for The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Washington.
I'm Meredith Vieira.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl. Those stories and Andy Rooney tonight on 60 Minutes.
Each Sunday evening, 26 million viewers tune in to CBS and its franchise news program, 60 Minutes. From its first trailblazing shows in 1968, 60 Minutes shook up the stodgy, predictable world of television news with a brash, dramatic style and a magazine format that has spawned many imitators and epic battles over ego and airtime. But the stopwatch ticks for everyone and every show. Stars are aging, future unclear. This hour, On Point, the saga of 60 Minutes and the future of a TV news phenomenon. Does your head still turn to the ticking clock of 60 Minutes? Do you remember when it transformed TV news? What's the future, what's the legacy of this television institution? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is David Blum, author of Tick, 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 The Long Life and Turbulent Times of 60 Minutes. He teaches at Columbia Journalism School, is TV critic for the New York Sun, and a regular contributor to Esquire and the New York Times Magazine. He spent 2 years in the inner sanctum of 60 Minutes, following its stars and producers. David Blum, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
So here we are, 36 years, and CBS 60 Minutes itself back in the news. What went through your mind last week when Dan Rather had to come out and on the 60 Minutes hook make his apologies for these papers and their uncertain origins?
Sheer amazement. I mean, the sight of Rather doing that was stunning. I was very disappointed with the content of it, though. His apology was narrow to the point of not being specific at all, and I think it's only managed to further this controversy that now seems like it'll go on for weeks, if not months.
And it rages on right now. We're looking with you tonight at an institution that's been around so long, you really can't ignore that fact when you watch it. Its stars are now getting old. Mike Wallace, 86, Morley Safer, 70-something.
They've gotten old. I mean, Steve Croft is the youngest. He's 58. He'd like to retire, but, you know, it's embarrassing to retire when there's somebody on the show who's 86 and still going. So that being Mike Wallace, and Andy Rooney's 87. So it's an astonishing longevity situation that no one's ever quite been able to figure out.
And Mike Wallace now saying he might do another year, you report.
Right. This'll.
So it's not forever.
I would think this will be close to his last year. You know, it's hard for him to do these pieces. He doesn't have the strength or the energy. He's still pretty agile for his age, but it's hard. You know, it's a lot of traveling, a lot of heavy lifting, and he's really not into that anymore.
There's a lot we want to hear tonight about the origins and the possible futures for this show. But tell us first, David Blum, how did you get so deeply inside? What was your relationship with 60 Minutes that gave you all the access that led to the pretty astonishing stories that you tell in this book?
Well, I had no access to 60 Minutes or CBS. I wrote a letter to Don Hewitt, and he called me right back and said he'd love to cooperate as long as I could get the approval of CBS News. I went to them. I went to Andrew Hayward, the president of CBS News. He said, okay. I think there was a feeling that the show was in transition. It was an exciting time for the show's future, and it would be interesting to have a journalist hanging around and following it. You know, this is a historic show, as you said. It's been around for almost 40 years. No one had ever really done a serious book except for some memoirs by Don Hewitt and Mike Wallace and others. So I was pleased. I think they actually had a sense of their own history and their own importance and felt that somebody ought to write it down.
Which all meant that on May 30th of this year, when Don Hewitt, the executive producer, creator, kind of a moving force behind 60 Minutes, was finally moving out of the show at age 81. You were there when he came down to a conference room expecting some kind of meeting and, in fact, faced his staff and a lot of the correspondents. And this was the au revoir. This was the party.
Yes, they're really, you know, it's one of the most depressing of all 60 Minutes traditions is the office party. And people had always told me that they were a sight to behold. And this one truly was. I mean, the fact that here is this guy who'd been at the helm of 60 Minutes for its entire history, 36 years. And, you know, there's a party with plastic glasses and cheap champagne and a bunch of hors d'oeuvres. I mean, it was
for a show that has brought, you report, something like $2 billion into CBS coffers over the years.
And I don't think that particular fact was lost on Hewitt. I mean, there were other fancier parties for him, so he could never. I mean, this was a surprise. But this was the staff party. And as a result, seeing him once again rail at CBS for not allowing him to stay at 60 Minutes was, you know, shocking, depressing, sad.
It's a real trailblazing done by this show, but incredible tensions inside it. We want to hear some about that from you. But you quote from a fax that Morley Safer had sent. He wasn't there. He was on vacation in Spain. And he wraps it up with, "Yours with the usual mix of anxiety and frustration," and despite all, deep and abiding respect and affection, Morley.
Yes.
And then this great moment where Hewitt's number two, Josh Howard, says, with the 60 Minutes staff party, "Without you, none of us would be here, and there are a lot of cars and houses and college educations that we have you to thank for."
Right.
And somebody else chiming in from behind a wall of staffers, "Psychotherapists as well." A real roiling ball inside this staff.
Yes, you know, it's really incredible to see. I mean, here's this guy, Hewitt, who's really, you know, a dynamic, powerful individual, has been around for 50 years, basically the entire history of television news. So, of course, you look up to him. He's an object of admiration. But at the same time, he's his own biggest fan. And after a while, that got very tiring for the people at 60 Minutes to constantly hear Don repeat endlessly the same stories of his greatness and his dominance in television. And he annoyed as much as he enthralled. It was a very complicated relationship between him and everyone else at 60 Minutes.
And great screaming matches and ego contests. And behind it all, some really important trends in television news, the way it was, the way it is now. I want to talk with you tonight about the way it may be in the next generation of 60 Minutes or whatever follows. We're talking tonight about CBS's 60 Minutes, the news show that shook up American TV news and is now being shaken up itself. My guest is David Blum. He is author of Tick, 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 The Long Life and Turbulent Times of 60 Minutes. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you remember when 60 Minutes was appointment television for the entire country? Is it still in your house? And when you hear that tick, 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 what do you expect? How do you define the 60 Minutes style? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the inside story of 60 Minutes.
I'm Harry Reasoner.
I'm Mike Wallace.
Why is Churchill important?
Mike,
because
Mike,
he hates
Mike,
poets
Mike,
and poets
Mike,
hate
Mike,
him.
You know that.
Oh, come on, John.
Mike Wallace and Don Hewitt going at it. And there, of course, Harry Reasoner and Mike Wallace. David Blum is with me. He's author of the new book, Tick, 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 The Long Life and Turbulent Times of 60 Minutes. And David, it was, at the beginning, Mike and Harry.
Yes. Well, at the very beginning, it was actually just Harry. But then somebody, not Don Hewitt, said, hey, did you ever think about two guys? And Hewitt said, interesting. Who do you have in mind? And this guy by the name of Bob Chandler, long forgotten, but the originator of this idea said, you know, Mike Wallace might be good. And lo and behold, the team was born, and it fit perfectly into this idea that Hewitt had of sort of a black hat, white hat approach, where Wallace would obviously be the black hat, tough guy, and
yeah.
Reasoner, the softy.
And remind us what it was when 60 Minutes burst on the scene that this show brought to television. What was the china that got broken here? What was the new format, the new gist that had everybody talking for a long time?
Well, really it was the idea that you could tell a story in 12 to 14 minutes, a good story that didn't need to be stretched out to an hour or 2 hours in documentary format. Up till then, CBS News had been at the forefront of the documentary, but people were starting to get a little tired of the hour-long format.
So it was either the evening news or the long form, and 60 Minutes
right.
came in the middle ground.
Right. So Hewitt saw, with the success of Life magazine at the time, that was obviously one of the most successful magazines of the day, and enjoyed its mix of serious journalism and Norman Mailer essays and, mm-hmm. you know, Marilyn Monroe cover stories, and thought, you know, if I could just figure out how to get that mix into a TV show, then I'd have a hit. And to his credit, he found the mix.
And in the style of journalism that it championed and the many imitators mm-hmm. or, I don't know, cousins that it spawned, how would you describe it? What was it that it brought to television journalism itself? Not just the format, but it's a way of approaching a story, approaching its subjects.
Right. Well, that happened actually sometime after Harry Reasoner left in the early 70s when Mike Wallace began to really dominate the show and Roy Safer joined and was also very tough. That the two of them saw the opportunity to be the sort of champion of the little guy. So they would go after Medicaid fraud, land fraud, real estate fraud, doctors who'd committed crimes. So, and eventually the idea of a hidden camera came into play. That became Mike Wallace's trademark, as was this notion of gotcha journalism, where you basically try and catch somebody in the act of doing something wrong or illegal. So they were very aggressive, very innovative, doing all sorts of things nobody else had tried. And it became known as the 60 Minutes brand of journalism until finally it became copied by so many people that 60 Minutes actually had to stop doing gotcha journalism because it looked like they were copying everyone else.
Mike Wallace didn't come to this style overnight. You remind us that he had a long career before this. Give us a sense of where Mike Wallace came from and what his career had been about before 60 Minutes and where it stood when he joined 60 Minutes.
It's amazing, really. I mean, he was born in Brookline, Massachusetts. He went to University of Michigan, Interlochen Music Camp. Then he became was a radio performer. Then he moved to New York, became a Broadway actor, bounced around on various kinds of shows until he finally settled in the late 50s into an interview format in which he would grill everyone and anyone with his brand of tough questions. And also he, not Don Hewitt, evolved the notion of the tight close-up on that show.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked very well for a time. He, though, began to struggle. His eldest son died in a strange accident in Greece. That kind of transformed Wallace and made him want to get into the news business, serious
news.
Just
before he came on to 60 Minutes.
Yeah, relatively soon, in the mid-60s.
I mean, not just before, but yeah.
Right. So he spent about 3 or 4 years bouncing around CBS News. In 68, he was covering the what seemed to be fledgling Nixon campaign and befriended Nixon. And in fact, there was a lot of talk between Wallace and Nixon about the possibility of Wallace becoming his press secretary, a job that eventually went to Ron Ziegler.
Mm-hmm. He always had the reputation for this abrasive, aggressive style that, as you say, eventually became the kind of trademark of 60 Minutes. Don Hewitt, on the other hand, the executive producer, brought his own sort of frenetic energy here that had not always been welcome at CBS, was not always welcome with the CBS News anchor, Walter Cronkite.
No, he was a very aggressive producer, always determined to get the story at any cost, and that was not Cronkite's way. Cronkite was a very serious, very by-the-book journalist. And there were a number of instances, one famous incident in which he had Cronkite interviewing Frank Sinatra. There were questions that Sinatra said, you cannot ask. Nevertheless, Hewitt went up to Cronkite, whispered in his ear, ask him about the mafia, ask him about his wife, Mia Farrow, who he didn't want to talk about. And Sinatra stormed out of the interview saying, you lied to me, Hewitt, and really never forgave him. But the piece aired. It actually was quite positive about Frank Sinatra. That, of course, is one of the ironies. But Hewitt just hated playing by the rules. He was a front-page-style Hildy Johnson reporter at heart.
And give us a sense, David Blum, you write about it in quite a lot of detail, of the back scene at 60 Minutes, just titanic ego clashes, clashes over who would get a particular story. Give us some tales that illustrate just how rough it could be inside the 60 Minutes cocoon.
Oh, just horrible. I mean, you know, when Ed Bradley came to work there, the first day he posed for a group portrait with everybody, and Mike Wallace leaned down to him just before the shutter was snapped and whispered into Bradley's ear, you know, if this show goes into the dumper, it's all your fault. And you can actually see in
Welcome
the
to the Roller
that's
Derby.
In the book that you can actually see the expression on Ed Bradley's face, like, what have I done now? And it just went on like that, where Wallace would steal producers from Bradley. Huge fights would occur. Diane Sawyer showed up. No one gave her an office. No one showed her where the ladies' room was. No one showed her where to get coffee. No one said hello.
So this was not a team, and still isn't, as you described.
No.
Even
no,
between Mike Wallace and Morley Safer, the two sort of, you know, grand figures there.
This would be a baseball stadium with five separate dugouts. I mean, these guys do not want to be anywhere near each other. They don't go out for drinks after work. They don't hang around in the hallway. They don't send each other birthday cards.
And they fight over stories. Who gets
All
to do
time.
Which story? How does that unfold?
Well, there's a process, what they call the blue sheet system, where you file a notice that you want to do a story. So basically, whenever anything happens in the world, everybody files a blue sheet, and it turns into an ugly battle. These fights have just never stopped. And oftentimes in the past, it resulted in long stretches of silence. I mean, Mike Wallace and Morley Safer didn't speak to each other for 2 years. Mike Wallace and just about everybody didn't speak to each other for some period of time. Mike Wallace in particular was not the easiest guy to work with.
He's a tough guy, and you can see it right on the screen. David
Blum,
stand by. We're talking about 60 Minutes tonight and its impact on American television. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined right now from New York by Peg Tyer. She's Newsweek magazine media critic, a former CNN reporter herself. Peg Tyer, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Peg, when you look at 60 Minutes, and I mean, it's still very much with us, but it's been around so long, it's got a legacy nonetheless. How would you describe it? Its imprint on what we get, what we expect from television news.
It really changed the model, and it really created a whole generation of television viewers who came to expect something very surprising, some investigative tinge to their television viewing.
Is it a positive thing that 60 Minutes brought, or did it turn it into theater? How do you see it?
Oh, I think it's been very positive. In terms of journalism, I think it was very positive, at least initially. It's changed and evolved a lot over the years. It's less investigative than it was in its heyday, and I think it suffers from that.
I can remember when the The kind of gotcha tension and the aggressiveness of the reporters was absolutely something new. And people just would rush home to their televisions on Sunday evening to see it. It was so crackling new. How would you describe the evolution since those days, maybe in the 70s, Peg?
It was thrilling. It was thrilling then. But where do you go for that kind of tension now? You go to maybe the O'Reilly factor, where one person boxes in another, you know, a guest, and you get that same sense of, like, there's going to be conflict. You get that same sense of two lions in a den. But so the medium through which we try and find that kind of tension and that kind of conflict has really changed. I think people's appetites for the quick investigation have waned. People are more – the viewers are more sophisticated now in a way. And sometimes I think they realize that people who are villainous in 15 minutes might have a larger backstory and a more complicated set of motives than can really be evoked in such a short format.
David Blum, how about it? Peg Tyrer sort of described 60 Minutes as a bridge between Walter Cronkite and Bill O'Reilly, sort of the blood sport that they introduced. Do you see that?
Yes. Well, you know, the fact is that the people who are running the show and who are on the show are of a different generation. So, you know, they are really stuck in the past, and it's been very difficult for them to evolve. I mean, their idea of doing a young pop star is doing Sheryl Crow, and it's not a very hip place. And as a result, I think the form could work if there were some new approach to it, a little bit different, but to, you know, after a certain point, you have to sort of acknowledge the fact that the world around you has changed, and maybe it's time to change yourself.
David Blum, Peg Tyrer, stand by. I want to invite our callers in. Cliff is calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Cliff. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Yes. Well, my question was this. You know, I always thought of 60 Minutes as kind of being the end of really meaningful news, or it was the beginning of the end, because it led to 2020 and Geraldo and hard copy and kind of the mainstream news we have now, which is almost entirely absent of information. Your speaker said watchers have gotten more sophisticated. I think really all they've gotten is more easily distracted by emotional content.
So you don't give it credit? I mean, 60 Minutes did go and do tough stories. They did, as David Blum says, position themselves as the champion of the viewers, of citizens. You see it all as a downhill slope?
Well, you know, you can go out and ask Frank Sinatra tough questions and probe into people's personal lives and stuff like that, but that's more of the same thing. I think it is worth going out there doing hard stories, but if you don't stick to the standard that your job is getting information and delivering it in that way, in that professional way, you're just taking people's ability away over time to think rationally about what's happening. Like now, there are no meaningful debates on television news at all, not just presidential debates. But you have these CNN bogus debates where you have the industry spokesman versus their crazy liberal or whatever. But nobody's telling me anything. I have to do all the work myself.
Got it. Cliff, thanks very much for your call. Peg Tyrer, how about it? You know how much disillusionment there is these days among the viewing public, the reading public, even the listening about the news industry and the media. How do you see the role of 60 Minutes in that? Our caller again says, sort of as you, this was the bridge to Geraldo.
I think that's probably right, but you also have to realize that there's other forces in the culture. We're not necessarily going to television for that, but there's a whole rise in the interest in long-form documentary all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. So people, in some ways, there's a sophisticated audience for debate, for information, for topics carefully examined. It just might not work on television.
David Blum, remind us of the really substantial news stories that 60 Minutes cracked open. It wasn't all just gotcha journalism. They really made their mark.
No, they did. I mean, they've gotten hundreds of people indicted and convicted for various kinds of environmental issues. And in one notable case that was early in their history, they exonerated a young black engineer named Liddell Jeter, who'd been in prison for murder and basically accumulated the evidence that he was innocent and got the case overturned. So that created almost an entire genre of exoneration journalism that's continued through today. So they started a lot that continued. But I think, you know, it's true there is this hunger now for long-form documentary, and I'm not sure what it means except to some extent it's an extension of 60 Minutes and that Michael Moore is to Fahrenheit 9/11 what Mike Wallace was to a 60 Minutes story, the central character, the hero that you're rooting for. And that idea that was essentially the idea of Don Hewitt in 60 Minutes has endured.
But more polemical in Michael Moore's hands than in Mike Wallace's. Rick is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi, yeah. I'm just calling, and I think most of my question has been answered, but I guess I'm incredibly naive at the age of 53, which is kind of sad, that I thought that the regular stations like ABC, CBS, and NBC were to be held to a higher standard of integrity for newscasting than, like, Murdoch and others like that.
And what are you suggesting that it's?
Am I just completely naive and completely wrong? I mean, is it just like ratings, and all this time I've just mistakenly thought they were had integrity?
No, it's ratings.
Well, yes and no. I mean, Peg Tyre. I don't know. Rick has the impression here. Yes, there's been some controversies and even some scandals around 60 Minutes. But in general, this is not a show where the integrity has been. Has been on the line all the time. It's been questioned all the time. They've, on the contrary, haven't they? Been sort of integrity's been a hallmark here, even while
they
went rough and tough.
They play it pretty straight. I mean, they are considered the gold standard for television journalism. Journalism has changed the standards of journalism. It's not like they're written down somewhere, and certainly different networks now seem to have different standards, and certainly standards. That entertainment divisions have sort of seeped into the news divisions. We see that with CBS, and sometimes it's a little unclear what you're getting, whether it's an entertainment show or a news show.
And when you see what's going on at Fox, David Blum, and what you observed at 60 Minutes, how wide mm-hmm. the gulf between, or how narrow?
Well, they're both interested in ratings. Don Hewitt is obsessed with them, and I don't think there's anything really wrong with that. In fact, it isn't a coincidence that 60 Minutes earned $2 billion for CBS. I mean, he was very concerned about drawing as big of an audience as he possibly could. And that does drive producers and correspondents to the point where mistakes can be made. And I think that's what that caller was trying to say, was that, he hoped or fantasized that CBS might have some higher standard. And yes, they do. But when you hold yourself to that higher standard, you're leaving more room to fail.
The same producer that was behind these Bush National Guard papers was in the middle of cracking the Abu Ghraib story this spring.
She did crack it and would probably be on her way to a number of Emmy Awards were it not for the fact that she screwed up in this most recent story pretty badly. So it seems.
Not the best moment, Peg Tyre. They're wrestling with Dan Rather's problems. Those stretch right over 60 Minutes right now.
There's a great concern as to what his role is going to be in the network.
We're going to come back and hear in a minute about how Dan Rather first came on, how all the correspondents came into this crew of 60 Minutes. You can join us when we do. What do you think? Does the flap over Dan Rather and the bogus Bush papers have you worried for 60 Minutes' future? The 60 Minutes delivered the sizzle with its ambush journalism. Did it deliver the steak, insight on the issues that really matter? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, David Blum, author of Tick, 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 The Long Life and Turbulent Times of 60 Minutes, and Peg Tyre, Newsweek magazine media critic. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about 60 Minutes, the news show that shook up American TV news and is now being shaken up itself. My guest tonight, David Blum, author of Tick, 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 The Long Life and Turbulent Times of 60 Minutes, and from New York, Peg Tyre, Newsweek magazine's media critic. You can join our conversation as well. When you hear that ticking sound, what do you expect? How do you define the 60 Minutes style? What about the epic off-air fights David Blum describes? Would you have guessed it? And how about the offspring of 60 Minutes, the many other TV news magazines? How do they stack up? Did you notice that the gang at 60 Minutes has put on a few years? How long can this go on? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. David Blum, I wish you'd sort of take us through the 60 Minutes stable of correspondents and the roles that the different individuals have played here and where they stand now and their attitude toward the show, their role.
Well, let's see. You know, Mike Wallace is the oldest, 86, you know, been the, as we've discussed, the originator of so many of the great forms of journalism, 60 Minutes is championed, but tired, not able to do as much as he used to. Morley Safer, 72, still chain smokes Rothmans and drinks and somehow manages, like the rest of them, to avoid any consequences for his lifestyle.
and many more years to him.
It's amazing. They're all fairly well. Actually, Ed Bradley, interestingly enough, was the healthiest of the bunch. Went to the gym every day for lunch.
Was the healthiest?
Was yes, exactly. Until last year, when he had quintuple heart bypass surgery, followed by an emergency appendectomy, and everyone who had followed his model was, you know, of behavior immediately switched their diet to donuts. So it was a quite a revelation. But and Steve Croft, 58, the youngest of the bunch, and Leslie Stahl in her early 60s, still not quite having achieved the level of stature that she would like. She's obsessed with being on camera. They all are. They all love the red light.
And they fight for that time, that on-air, on-camera time.
Desperately. No, it's incredible. There's something about television that really is a narcotic. You know, Dan Rather is said to be a guy who would spend the rest of his life chasing a red light around a building just to be on television. And, you know, he has no intention of retiring or resigning. And I'm sure we'll be doing everything he possibly can over the next few months to make sure that doesn't happen.
Rick is calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I wanted to comment real briefly on the gold standard, as it were, of 60 Minutes. I took a journalism class as an undergrad at Xavier University in the early 1980s. And in that class, the professor showed us an actual clip from 60 Minutes as young, impressionable students. We were very taken aback at the egregious behavior of the people that they were speaking about. And following that clip, the professor showed us the entire content of the interviews that made up that segment, and the outcome was entirely different, completely contradictory to what we initially saw in 60 Minutes. And while I have watched it sporadically since then, I've never really much credence to the outcome of their particular segments.
And Rick, what was the lesson that your journalism professor wanted you to take away from that comparison?
That take all journalism, and I think in his case, specifically 60 Minutes, with a grain of salt, that it wasn't hard journalism, it was entertainment, and it wasn't necessary. You weren't necessarily seeing all of the facts of each particular case.
Rick, we've got it, and thanks for your call. David Blum, how fair, how unfair, how much was the footage, is the footage massaged at 60 Minutes to get those amazing gotcha moments?
Well, look, I don't think it's massaged. And in fact, they have somebody who works full time to double check the context of quotes.
I mean, but, in the sense of edited.
I think he's absolutely right. But I don't think that's, to my mind, a criticism of 60 Minutes. I mean, it's a, you know, it's fair journalism, but it's not objective journalism. It's told from a point of view. And that, I think, is a very honest way of going about it. And yes, it's designed to be entertaining, but that's why 60 Minutes is still on television, because it's entertaining. There's absolutely no reason why things shouldn't be entertaining, and that's something I think Michael Moore has realized too, or Morgan Spurlock, who made Super Size Me, and all these documentaries that have done so well. People enjoy, you know, taking their medication with a little bit of flavoring, and that's what 60 Minutes provides and continues to. I mean, sometimes it does it better than other times, and obviously when you're doing a serious piece of journalism, you want to be as balanced as you possibly can, but I think they do a decent job on that front.
And you don't buy the professor's critique that it's twisted so far that you don't get reality sometimes?
Well, you know, how do you define reality? I think it's a form of it, and, you know, in fact, I'd like to see more point of view in stories. I'd like to see more attitude from the correspondents and more of what they think and feel. I think that makes it interesting, and I don't think it necessarily diminishes from what you learn and what you gain from watching a piece of journalism on 60 Minutes. So yeah. I think the professor was right, and I think it's a good thing.
It's better than reading a press release handout from somebody, Peg Tyre.
Well, I have to disagree with David. I think that we need to maintain some distance, and that I can't imagine that people want to hear the opinions of journalists. They really want to hear the news. I mean, our job is really to get the news and to transmit it to our readers or our viewers as accurately and as fairly as we can.
David Blum's been making this twinning to a degree of Michael Moore and the 60 Minutes crew. Do you buy that, Peg Tyre? Do you see them in the same camp or somewhere along the same part of the spectrum?
Well, I mean, I think David's point is very well taken, that this was a show that began to mix news and entertainment in a very sophisticated way. It also was a meaty show. It gave people something to think about. And
sure did.
And in that way, I think it did raise a whole generation of viewers with certain expectations for television news. You know, Michael Moore is a product of what's happened since then. There were all the offspring of 60 Minutes, and I think that those offspring sort of degenerated a little bit. They got sort of worse and worse, and I think that Michael Moore is kind of an offshoot of that.
Marty's calling from Boston. Hi, Marty. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question about the fairness and justice issue. A person that meant a lot to me earlier in my life anyway was Tony Herbert. And Tony was a very highly decorated Korean War soldier and was later in the Vietnam War and accused the government of some war crimes. And a 60 Minutes show was done on him, which he felt anyway severely slandered his reputation and his claims that he had made. And that led to a long, prolonged court battle, including going off the Supreme Court. I've always heard his point of view, which was that 60 Minutes was not at all just or fair. I've always wondered what the other side of the equation might have been.
Marty, thanks for your call. David Blum, you know, many people, when the world of journalism comes to focus on them, end up feeling a bit beat up, and sometimes more than that. More so in the case of 60 Minutes, or just more amplitude?
Well, Tony Herbert got it socked to him pretty hard, and that was a great story that Mike Wallace did. And that, by the way, is an example of what I was talking about point of view. Not that these correspondents ought to be spouting their opinions, but that they obviously, for example, in the Anthony Herbert case, cared about a guy who was lying about war atrocities. And they investigated him thoroughly and found that the people he'd quoted in his own book denied the incidents that he claimed had taken place. And it was a stunning piece of television in which Wallace basically brought in these people that were supposed witnesses and had them contradict Herbert to his face. And I guess the final coda to the story is that Herbert did lose his libel case, both at the Supreme Court and at every other level.
So it cannot have been fun, and it could ruin a life on that kind of high public exposure. But in that case, it came down on his side. Peggy Tyre, where do you see 60 Minutes going? We've got some very old stars here, but some younger people, too. A new executive producer there, Jeffrey Fager. Where's it headed?
Well, I want to get back to the last caller's point, and that is, you know, what he's really asking is, who's the community for 60 Minutes and where is the accountability? When you work for a newspaper, if you get it wrong, people write into the newspaper and they write into the ombudsman or they write a letter to the editor. And what you're seeing now is you're seeing, with the rise of the internet, a tremendous number of people who respond to national television shows. And suddenly 60 Minutes doesn't quite have the omnipotence that they once did. They're not quite the last word anymore.
Not immune, but where does that last word go, Peg Tyre? We've just got half a minute here. Where do you see it headed, the show?
I think it's going to be around for a while. I think that the new show is obviously picking up some speed, and you know, it has a long tradition. I think it will continue for some time.
And David Blum, your guess, you've spent a long time looking at it, 20 seconds here, but how do you see the future?
Oh, it'll stick around. I mean, eventually they'll find new correspondents. I doubt they'll be as good, and maybe the show will, at that point, begin to really lose its steam. But I think it's got a good 5 or 10 years left.
Well, we'll be watching. Peg Tyre at Newsweek, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you.
And David Blum, author of Tick, 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 The Long Life in Turbulent Times of 60 Minutes. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, a rabbi's reflections for Yom Kippur. This is On Point. sundown tonight marked the beginning of the Jewish holiday Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the holiest day on the Jewish calendar, and the end of the High Holy Days, a 10-day period of reflection. This year, the holiday falls in the midst of reports of genocide in Sudan, hostage beheadings in Iraq, mortar bombings in Israel. On Rosh Hashanah, at the beginning of the High Holy Days, Rabbi Harold Schulweis of the Conservative Congregation of Valley Beth Shalom in Encino, California, put out a call for a new commission of Jews to monitor reports of atrocities and speak out against injustice in the world. Tonight, in this radio diary, Rabbi Schulweis reflects on the meaning of Yom Kippur this year.
Yom Kippur is a moment in which one afflicts one's soul, not one's body. It is an opportunity to place a mirror before one's soul and to see whether or not the divine potentiality has been realized over this past year. I think it's imperative for the Judaism to recognize itself as a world religion, and that its agenda is the agenda of God in this world. And therefore, if you accept that, you have to think globally. You have to appreciate that globalization is not only a technological, industrial, and commercial new life, but it's spiritually a new way of thinking. Moment here of awakening, an opportunity in which you simply cannot allow the world to be decided by military strategians, by generals, and by missile competence. And I think that this is the basic obligation of world religion, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. We have an obligation to the world. Because if we fail, then we have removed the stature of God and we have mocked the significance of our prayers and of our prophets. That's how we begin a new year, a new month, a new life. With the capacity to begin anew and not to allow the sins and wrongdoings and sadnesses of the past to paralyze our present and to eclipse the hope of the future. The pragmatics that follow from this beginning is to look at the world with new eyes and new responsibilities, to open the newspaper and to recognize that when there are people who are suffering in this fashion and nations that are playing political games have to be transcended by religious sensibilities and by that which all religions have in common, and that is conscience.
Rabbi Harold Schulweis of the Conservative Congregation of Valley Beth Shalom in Encino, California, with his thoughts on Yom Kippur this year. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.